You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 69, Clive Barker's Candyman, featuring urban legends, crack dealers, bees, razor blades, hooks, disembowelings, graffiti dungeons, Xander Berkeley, a plethora of white women, Father Radio Raheem, and bad boy Ted Raimi, Martin.
Yes.
But what is blood if not for shedding? Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, we lied. We were supposed to do Ozploitation, but then you fell in love.
I got a girlfriend.
You got a girlfriend. You didn't have time to watch 30-minute movies, and I did. So instead, we're doing, honestly, one of our favorite movies of all time, Clive Barker's Candyman from 1992. We always talk about, you know, with Freddy Krueger this month, and this is kind of going to put the period to the end of 2024's spooky season, but it's going out in pretty great fashion because we said with the Freddy Krueger episode in Nightmare on Elm Street is that we'd kind of covered all of the major slasher franchises to date. And I still think that holds true, but until you had kind of pitched this as a, let's say a mini episode, so that it kind of buys you a little more time to watch more Australian films.
Never a bad thing to watch more time. No. Yeah.
Oh, dude, I've watched so many of them and I've been having such a blast. So as soon as you were like, oh man, I need more time, I was like, sure. I'm going to be up to like 40 by the time you catch up. But this, I don't know if this counts as one of the major franchises. That was one of the questions I had for myself while I was revisiting Candyman for, I don't know, the 40th time, is that I think this is a big name horror movie right up to, you know, Jordan Peele executive producing the reboot of it a couple years ago. But I don't know if I consider this one of the major slasher franchises.
Nope. Agreed. I think that they've, I think from the outside and like from merchandising, yes. You know, I have a freaking pin of Candyman on my jacket over here.
You have a shirt?
I have a shirt, my Japanese, yeah, which is
the Rocking Fotten one.
Which is fucking awesome. But
I'm wearing a Godzilla one right now.
But he's just also not a strict slasher. He's you know,
yeah,
he's really unique. I think what really sets specifically the first one apart, and I think what they tried to echo in the second and then with the reboot is classy. That there's a classy, like artsy side that they're trying to hold. And it came from Bernard Rose as the director. And I was went down a rabbit hole today watching some special features on the Blu-ray.
Sure.
And I didn't realize, it's one of those things that we can get into it more with the second one, but it's like, where do what we know as the mythology of Candyman come from? And reading the short story, The Forbidden by Clive Barker, you know, none of the stuff was there about the saying the name five times in the mirror.
No.
Race is not an issue at all in the book. It's more about class. Obviously, the setting is different. It's in Liverpool instead of Cabrini Green, Chicago.
But Helen Lyle is still the main character.
And she's still
going in to study graffiti.
Yeah. So you have graffiti in the book and then the idea of urban legends and tales in the movie. You know, but you have, it's interesting to see how much of this came from Bernard Rose and not from Barker.
I was going to ask you, since you dove into this, does he discuss why he transmuted it from being just graffiti into urban legends itself?
That he did not when I was seeing him, but the one thing he made the big choice to go to America, and partly was in American productions where they got the money from. And because
it's Columbia, right?
I believe it's Columbia, and he optioned it. So he had, he and Barker had the same agent at CAA, and then got connected, and then through that, or there was also a story, maybe apocryphal, of when he was shooting one of his films, it was at Pinewood right next to Nightbreed. when they were shooting Nightbreed, and they met there and had dinner together or lunch, and then he's like, oh, let me read some of your stuff. And
he had it while he was shooting the now notorious Paper House?
No, it was, we'll get into that later, but it was after Paper House. It was like 90.
Okay.
But...
because Candyman's 92. I didn't know there was one in between Paper House and that.
I forget the name, to be honest. I've only seen a few of his films. I've seen Paper House, this, and I've seen Immortal Beloved, which I like a lot.
The Gary Oldman Beethoven movie.
Yeah.
And, quite good.
But it's...
lot of crazy Gary Oldman in that movie.
the Moonlight Sonata scene is amazing.
Yeah. That whole movie's really good.
Yeah. But
it was kind of forgotten.
It was interesting with this movie, though, is like... that's what I always think about when I think of Candyman is like beyond Barker is like classiness and artsiness, because the original pitch, from what I've read, and this goes into what happened with hiring Philip Glass, one of my favorite composers, which adds this whole other level to this movie. You can't talk about this movie without the amazing score.
Yeah.
Was.
And it's a true Philip Glass score. Oh, all atonal.
It's amazing. But he, and weird syncopation, but he does the, so the story goes that the original pitch for the movie was going to be very goreless. It was going to be much more spooky, obviously atmospheric as it is. And I believe a lot of the kill scenes are reshoots that were added in. And Philip Glass was And Philip Glass was so mad, and Bernard Rose was so mad, that he wanted his score like off the movie.
Yeah, he disowned the movie entirely. Yeah.
And
it becomes the most, well, not the most iconic part, but one of the most iconic bits of the movie.
Well, and 100%. And I think they still had the rights, because he wrote no new music for the second one. It's just the music from the first, but they still owned the rights to the music and used it for the sequel.
Well, and in the Jordan Peele reboot, they reinterpret it, and kind of needle drop. Yeah, the score for the Jordan Peele one is quite good, which we should also say is directed by Nia DaCosta.
Yes.
He did not direct it. He just kind of masterminded it.
Yeah, and wrote the original screenplay, I believe. Yeah.
But like, they reinterpret the score for the reboot and really only kind of needle drop the original organ theme right at the end.
And one point earlier during one of the shadow puppet plays, there's a moment of that. You hear it. They hint it.
Yeah. I think it's in the, it's almost like, yeah, exactly. Like it's coming.
Yeah.
But where does this stack up when it comes to Hellraiser for you in terms of Barker adaptations?
I think this is my favorite.
Candyman. I would agree with you.
I just think this
movie still fucks me up even at 41 years old. Like I watched this. The last time I had watched it was when the reboot came out. Yep. I watched it the day that I went to the press screening.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a press screening. I watched it in my living room because I got a screener of it because it was during COVID.
Yeah.
Or at the tail end of COVID, I want to say.
It was like 2021, right?
Yeah. And so it was right when I started to go back to movie theaters. I watched the first one in broad daylight, and I was still freaked out by it. I think this movie is incredibly effective.
Yeah, it's perfect. Well, and I hadn't watched it since I got my surround sound.
Yeah.
And it was a couple months ago, I popped it in. I watch it a lot. I'm constantly rewatching. And with the music up blast, it's a fully atmospheric, fully immersive film. And it's just all the shit that we like. You know, like I love urban legends. I love
it. It might be the most Jacob and Martin coded movie of all time because shares. It's like a perfect intersection of all of our interests.
No, you're right. No, 100%. An idea of like myths and like story as an entity.
Boogeymen.
Boogeymen.
Inhabiting like modern American spaces. And then just for
urban
me,
spaces.
That urban grime.
Yep.
Very gross inner city like feel that I, you know, want in every movie practically. Like all of the stuff where Helen and her best friend go in to research the Candyman and go into the Cabrini Green projects in Chicago and encounter the drug dealers and everything. Like that stuff is just as scary as the supernatural elements when Tony Todd shows up as the, you know, the iconic Candyman. But like, because Rose captures it, and maybe this is because he's an Englishman coming to America and shooting it kind of like in the same way we always bring up like Vim Vendors making Paris, Texas and shooting Texas with almost like an alien's eye, is that there's that outsider's kind of feel to the way that Rose shoots Cabrini Green and Chicago, or even from like the early like aerial footage, that you almost feel like, and I want to be sensitive on how I say this because we're dealing, you know, with inner city characters and everything, but it almost feels like a nature video at times, to where like he's keeping you at a remove and allowing you to kind of observe until it's too late. And then he gets in and gets very intimate, especially like during that early confrontation with Helen and the drug dealer who's using the Candyman myth to basically like chase people off of his turf and assaults her in the bathroom and everything. Like, then all of a sudden it's almost like he gets you up close and personal when it's too late and you can't escape.
Well, and I have the short story collection right here. But the opening line is very much that from Barker: like a flawless tragedy, the elegance of which structure is lost upon those suffering in it. The perfect geometry of the Spectre Street estate was visible only from the air. It's the idea of remove, right? And the idea of these also, I think, getting into, not to get pretentious with it, but like political and societal structures which have put people in these places, right? Looking from the air, you can be detached, but it's like you can forget about the horrors that happen in these hallways, right?
Right, but that's what Candyman's about, right?
Exactly.
It's essentially, and it's the thing that I struggle with the most when it comes to the reboot, is it's about gentrification, right? It's about how these spaces change and how they morph over time, depending on the populations that come in and redesign the spaces, reutilize them for different purposes, kick the people who inhabited them out in the first time. And it's about the legends that these people basically leave behind and how they're exploited by those who are still kept in the lowest parts of that kind of societal dregs. Because that's the thing, is like, for these white academics in Candyman, for Helen and the professors and everything, it's the University of Chicago,
I believe so,
right?
Yeah.
Or the University of Illinois, it might be. To them, it's nothing but like an artifact to be studied.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But to these, to the drug dealers and the people who still live in the ghetto and everything, Candyman means something totally different. For a drug dealer, it's a way to defend his turf and instill fear in people. And the people who live in these tenement buildings, like the Candyman was used to explain murders because somebody was basically crawling through the medicine cabinet spaces and invading homes and killing people. And then, of course, they became like the Candyman murders because, you know, that was just a way for the people in the inner city to essentially rationalize what was happening at the time. And that's kind of the most fascinating element of the original Candyman, is like it becomes about the stories we tell, the monsters we create, and then the people who exploit them, either for intellectual and academic gain or for very low-level financial gain, or even just like kind of personal protection or spiritual protection, and like a way to go to sleep at night, to being like, well, a real person didn't crawl through that medicine cabinet. Candyman got them. It helps me sleep better.
Yeah. No, and I think the other thing, too, I was reading in this book, Clive Barker's Dark Worlds, this kind of coffee table book from a few years ago, and there's a great section on Candyman. They talk about, I think it's Barker talked about, this is what happens when people forget a god. It's like God ceased to exist if no one believes in him, right? And
well, and what's crazy is that's more what the reboot is about.
It becomes
about what happens when the tales that we tell over time vanish or lose the people who believe in them.
Yeah. Does it no longer have, and again, it brings, there's the connection to Freddy Krueger, right? And you get it then, that the first film of like, if I don't believe in him, it won't kill me. But even up to Freddy versus Jason, if we basically dull everyone's minds who knew about Freddy, he can't come back.
Yeah, we turn our back on him and it takes his power away.
Yeah, and with this, you need, you know, Candyman needs to be, he needs to be feared. And you also have with Helen, she kind of reawakens her interest, but also, you know, in this, it's interesting because, like, moving from the original Candyman to the reboot in 2020, I guess 2021, answers the question of, is Bernard, are these the people to tell this story, right? Is, and I'm not,
yeah,
but there's
no, 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 you're hitting on something that I was going to wait to jump on, but you go for it, because, like, that's kind of, I had a debate about this with our buddy Shapiro the other night of, like, we were talking about how, you know, the new Candyman, the Jordan Peele produced one, is a reclamation of the mythos by black filmmakers. But his big question is, reclamation from what? Like, why does this mythos have to be reclaimed in the first place? It was initially invented by a British man.
Oh, again, and there's no sense, the, it's more, again, more about class. And I was watching this on this documentary, I forget his name, a scholar who's written about Barker, and he's talking about how, you know, the main separators in England, especially like in the cities, like in Liverpool, is class based, right?
Yes.
It still is. Obviously, race.
And that's what that story is about.
It is about. And there's no mention really of race in these states, right?
No, they're all white.
Yeah.
They're all white British people.
But, you know, he made the decision, obviously, for financial reasons, but also he was interested in adding that extra level. Bernard Rose adding that extra level of race in America to this. Now, what's I find fascinating around all of this is just, again, how meta it all is here's Bernard Rose being like Helen, going to play in this space that is not his own, to use its elements to tell his story, for to make money,
yes,
to titillate. I don't think he would agree with that, but
no, that was one of the main points I landed on when me and Shapiro were talking about it, is that you couldn't, a white guy from England couldn't make a movie about a black boogeyman haunting the ghetto in 2024. We just, it wouldn't be allowed. Like, we've moved past that because we have evolved into our viewpoints on who can tell what stories.
Exactly.
And that's kind of the interesting thing about the sequel, because the reboot is a legacy sequel that's actually about legacy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which is what makes it kind of fascinating, is that it's literally about the reclamation of these mythos by black filmmakers, but they use it, and it's kind of my issue with the movie as a whole. They make the subtext,
yep,
of Candyman the main text.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird is that the Candyman reboot or legacy sequel, because it is a sequel.
Yeah.
Especially when we find out
who he is,
who the main character is. And it is, in a weird way, also a retread of what the sequels that came before, particularly Farewell to
yep,
the Flesh, already did, is that they make each character have a literal blood link to Candyman.
Yeah.
To Daniel Robitaille.
Yeah.
Who, I guess for those who are listening to a podcast episode about Candyman but have never actually seen Candyman, we'll fill in those blanks. Candyman was Daniel Robitaille. As the legend goes, he was a black artist who traveled mostly through the South doing portraits,
yeah,
of, you know, plantation owners and plantation owners'
like
daughters.
1890s.
In the late 1890s. And he does one particular portrait where he falls in love with one of the slave owner's daughters, gets her pregnant. Naturally, that doesn't sit well with the slave owner. He gets lynched. They cut his hand off with a rusty blade, replace it with a rusty meat hook, spread honey all over his body, and then let bees murder him. And to escape, he jumps through glass, through a mirror.
Oh,
mythos in Farewell to the Flesh.
You know, they show the mirror to his face, and they basically...
That's it,
and
yeah.
He says Candyman, so it creates...
Well, the kid calls him Candyman.
You're right, that's what it is.
It's the little kid who gives him... Because there's a little bit of honey that gets on the little kid's cheek, and he tastes it, and he goes, "Candy." And then the racist white woman standing next to him, she's like, "Candyman, that's his name, Candyman." And I'm just sitting there like, "Kill me now." But, like, it's an interesting addition to the mythos, but it's also kind of what makes, not to, I guess, for me to jump ahead and talk about Farewell to the Flesh. Farewell to the Flesh is almost like the Dream Warriors of the Candyman franchise. Like, especially if we're going to talk about Daniel Robitaille and Candyman and his relationship to Freddy Krueger is that he's basically like the black goth Freddy Krueger, with his Barry White ass voice just coming in and saying just crazy poetic, like type O negative style lyrics to Helen, like, your suffering will be exquisite even in hell. And you're like, are you a Cenobite? Like, what's going on here, sir?
Well, and that's it's a thing I have a problem with the sequels. Well, I really like a lot of Fear of the Flesh, and I appreciated more of the reboot this time. I hated it the first time, but we'll get into that a little bit later. But with a lot of Barker adaptations, the more you try to explain and give rules, the more power is lost. Because there's a dreaminess to the first Candyman that's about, like, you know, Barker talks about this with writing the story The Forbidden. It's about storytelling. It's about telling scary stories and why we tell them. He talks about Julia Kristeva and the idea of what is forbidden, this thing's discarded from civilization and from polite society. Where does it go? And so the story and then the first Candyman is so much more conceptual, right? Where it is this mystery of, you know, by the end, Helen, it's not this big, oh, I got to get this certain mirror. That's the way I'm going to beat him. You know, you get into that really horror movie rule bullshit, like you're saying with Dream Warriors.
Well, and it becomes, you know, like Dream Warriors, where like in Dream Warriors, that's where you get all of the Amanda Krueger stuff and everything.
Yes.
That's introduced to Freddy Krueger's lore for the first time. And that, like, in the original Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, Freddy Krueger was just a pederast who was basically lynched by the local parents, burned alive, and comes back to take revenge in the kids' dreams. And, like, you don't really get any of the Amanda Krueger, Son of 100 Maniacs type stuff until you get to part three. With Farewell to the Flesh, that's how it becomes. It's nowhere near as good as Dream Warriors.
No.
Yeah, make no mistake. But it's like, it is adding on all the extra kind of layers to the Candyman mythos. And to be fair, it's pretty clever, and the actual visualization of Daniel Robitaille's lynching is really chilling and fucked up.
Yeah.
So, like, I appreciate that part of it. But, yeah, to your point, too, though, then it becomes this, like, very tangible, mystical bullshit where it's like, oh, we found Daniel Robitaille's original mirror, and that's how you defeat him is by breaking this mirror at the end. And you're like, shut the fuck up. Like, the thing that makes Barker's writing so effective is that he's basically like the H.P. Lovecraft to Stephen King's Edgar Allan Poe, where it's like Stephen King wrote very tangible, not formulaic, because it is very imaginative, don't get me wrong, but like Stephen King's stuff is very pulpy, to the point, bestseller material.
Richard Matheson story.
Matheson is another great example too. But like Barker's very much into like the unexplained evil that exists in the world in the same way that H.P. Lovecraft was, to where it's all about this unknowable evil that just kind of permeates the world and arises out of the depths that we don't understand. And you don't really want an explanation behind it, because not knowing what makes it essentially work is what makes it so scary.
No, 100%. Because you have, and it's a great comparison, because again, Barker is so much more, he's so much more conceptual with his horror, is that, you know, and he's also,
and verbose, frankly.
And he's also a fantasist, you know, is he a lot of his later stuff, like the Aberrat series, are full on like kids, or like teen fantasies.
The Thief of Always.
Yeah. My favorite Barker book.
I love that book, but it's a kid's fantasy,
but
it's an incredible one,
but it's like, it's a full on like Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole, or even
that gets incredibly fucked up by the end.
Or even like a Dark Line, the Witch in the Wardrobe, of like, you get, here's all your Turkish delights, but like going far with that idea.
Even The Great and Secret Show gets into pretty fantastical. It's much more horror than like the Aberrat series.
Yeah, and Weave World.
But it's like, even Great and Secret Show has very fantastical elements to it.
Yes.
But where the reboot kind of drops the ball like a little bit, because here's the thing, is when I first saw it, I didn't love it, but like, there's stuff about it I respect. It. Nia DaCosta shoots the shit out of it.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
There's a lot of really interesting ideas. You know, Yahya Abdul-Mateen is like incredible in it. You have fucking Colman Domingo.
Oh my God.
You know, just doing when he like comes in and is the one who explains, you know, the Candyman mythos to our main protagonist. Like, you're like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, you just have like a straight up like future Oscar nominee.
Well, getting
like
classic, in the middle of classing up the movie. Joint though too, right? You get that classiness back, right?
But it's also the thing that makes the movie feel strangely dated. Like what, 3 years on, 4 years on at this point, is because it was at the height of what we now refer to as like social horror, you know, in the post kind of Get Out, Us wave. And that you had stuff like the Candyman reboot that like everything had to be like about a big issue, you know, especially like race. Like, remember that movie Antebellum that came out that literally transported people back to like slavery times where they were being kidnapped and moved to like modern plantations and shit?
Or the show Them.
Or the show Them.
The first season, yep.
Is another great example of that. But like Candyman unfortunately falls into this subcategory to where it's like Candyman just couldn't be a terrifying boogeyman where you say his name five times in front of a mirror and he appears and guts you with a hook anymore. He had to represent something more, which arguably he did in the original movie, but you kind of had to dig for it. Like, I remember seeing this movie for the first time when I was like 12 or whatever. I saw it down to the beach. My cousin Abby and my aunt Jackie's actually the girl I lost my virginity to. Yeah, different story for a different podcast. But we rented Candyman on VHS, stayed at my uncle's beach house, and stayed up and watched it all night, and it fucking scared the shit out of me. And I didn't think about, like, gentrification or urban legends or what they meant to different races of people when I was 12. All I knew is that I was watching this scary-ass motherfucker with a hook for a hand appear after you said his name five times in front of a mirror, and then he gutted the shit out of you. Because the other thing too is that like the original movie is gory as shit, and it's brutal and it's violent. The dog decapitation.
It's Bob Keen who did the Hellraiser movies.
Yeah, and it looks incredible. It has that very like visceral Clive Barker gore.
And the right type of red for blood.
Oh,
you know, that dark red.
That moment when Helen wakes up in kind of like the fugue state and has to get out of the apartment and it's like covered in blood and everything. That's terrifying.
Or when she has to strip down, that long scene of her stripping at the police station is so sad.
Yeah.
And she's like, can I have a towel? Can I think of the towel, please? She's peeling off her underwear because of the crusty blood. It's like,
yeah, you can actually hear the blood peeling off of it. The sound design in this movie too is just fucking insane. But also the scene where Candyman appears to her in like when she's being sedated and she's tied down to the bed, it's absolutely horrifying. But like the rebooted Candyman loses a lot of that impact because instead of being a visceral horror movie, it's so like capital A about something that it sort of loses its impact.
No, I agree, because I think the main hole in the movie is Candyman the bad guy? Is as simple as that. Is like, is he the villain of this movie? And I don't want to simplify it that much, but I think you need that. You think about Dracula, right? And he's a very Dracula, especially in the original, very Dracula-like character. He's seductive. He's very beautiful. He has this very low voice of like, come with me to a night of darkness, Dracula kind of thing. That's very romantic. He's like a very romantic, it's very gothic romance. Let's die together kind of thing.
And it's again doing the same Clive Barker thing to where he intertwines pain and pleasure,
yes,
romance and death. Like, it's just like that's his thing,
which is again very gothic, right? And you have the promise of there's, you know, also like, or you called me, I didn't ask you, called me, you said my name, or you opened the box, right? You know, it's all Pandora's box kind of stuff. And but with the newer film, I wasn't sure who the bad guy was. I wasn't sure. Candyman became too conceptual. You know, and what sucks is I really liked this time, the idea of Candyman is a concept that can wear many faces, right? And yeah. I like that idea because it really, rereading the short story, you have the sense that Candyman is not based on a real, he's not coming from a human place. He has yellow skin that he's almost like out of a carnival. They say blue yeah. lips. He is a fully conceptual idea of the Candyman who's come to life. Like, he maybe never existed. It's only because
he's almost like a monster out of Midian.
Exactly. Yeah. And you, very Barker. And like the descriptions of when you first meet the head Cenobite in Hellbound Heart, you know, versus becoming Pinhead, this very physical thing. But with that, by the end of the reboot, there's also, it tries to do so much. Like you said, it's about something, but it's so messy in its storytelling too.
Yeah,
by the end, it's all over the fucking place.
It's a collection of ideas more than it is an actual narrative. It's in search of a narrative.
Yep.
And like, you almost wonder why they didn't title it Candy Men.
I was thinking the same thing.
Because it's like,
that
because
been, you have a good title.
The multiple rep, and it would be better than just having another Candyman in the same way that like the Hellraiser reboot is just called Hellraiser. The Halloween reboot is just called fucking Halloween. It's almost like put a little oomph into these titles, man. Like just call it Candyman because that's the central thesis of the movie is, again, it literalizes the idea from the original and is like, okay, who tells these stories and what do they mean? Because in the new Candyman, you have, you know, the original one that's told is basically that it starts with the shadow puppetry mm-hmm. that basically rehashes the Daniel Robitaille story for yeah. those who don't recall, you know, and then, you know, you have another version of Candyman, which is this black man who actually did hand out candy yeah. in the ghetto.
Who had a hook, but like a prosthetic hook.
A prosthetic hook, exactly. Yeah. Who was non-threatening and almost presented as maybe simple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? And like, he basically gets mistaken for somebody who's wanted and becomes a victim of police brutality. And yeah. he's killed. And that's like, obviously a tale as old as time in the ghetto, and it's a way to essentially warn children, hey man, don't do this shit because like the police will eventually come and get you and beat you to death and make you the next Candyman. Mm. Like, and there's a couple different tales told inside of the new Candyman, and it's almost like, again, it repurposes. It almost becomes like a master's thesis more than it is a movie.
Yeah.
To where it's like, here are all of the different like stories that we tell and why we tell them. And then you have the art world component to it, to where Yahya Abdul-Mateen's character comes in and starts reinterpreting the Daniel Robitaille and Candyman mythos as the stories that he was told, you know, into like this art, you know, installment. And it like, again, it's like how we co-opt these myths and reinterpret them for like personal gain.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, Cabrini Green at this point is gone.
Yep.
The one from the original film. And now it's completely gentrified to not only like white people live there. It's basically almost like, you know, how they talk about Brooklyn
yeah.
in the early 2000s is that, or Williamsburg, when like basically all the musicians, like, you know, James Murphy and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and all those guys came from that kind of no wave scene in the early 2000s and lived in like Williamsburg and whatever. And it became like, instead of being a ghetto, it was now just this cheap housing for like artists who could live there. In this version of Cabrini Green, it's not cheap housing. It's all basically lofts and like, or essentially what's happening to Austin right now.
Yeah.
Like these overpriced, like high rises where only art dealers and tech bros and shit can basically live. And so like this poor artist lives with his art dealer girlfriend who sets him up with this show, and all of the like critics and art dealers and stuff are like these snobby hipster white dudes. And again, it like takes the concept that's hinted at and discussed in Candyman and just makes it the movie.
When you have the line too, I mean, there's some, again, as a thesis, there's some really interesting stuff to like take down, but not as a movie, right? You have that line where I think it's really great where he said, you know, they want what we make, not us. Right.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is very powerful. And you have also, I mean, the connection to Get Out too, of like, they want our bodies, but they want to live inside of it, right?
Right.
It's like, and there's all this stuff
Young
going
blood.
Yeah, there's all this stuff going on inside the movie. And this time I think as a film, like Nia DaCosta, it's shot so well, the music's great. I kind of gave myself over to it today and was just like, it's got a really good vibe, very similar to the original, of that very mystical kind of just like wavy feel to the entire film. But this one, again, when it tries to explain the last 30 minutes, it totally shits the bed. Honestly, for the first hour, I don't have a lot of problems with it.
I guess spoilers for those who have never seen this one, but like, it's once they reveal that Coleman Domingo is basically the bad guy, and they never really like set this up in any way. It kind of comes out of nowhere to where it's like, he was waiting to basically resurrect Candyman, because it becomes about what you were talking about earlier, is that it's like, if a legend is forgotten, it loses all of its power. And Coleman Domingo is almost like this guy who lives in the hood and remembers old school Cabrini Green and operates a laundromat. And like, he's waiting for the right moment to essentially like resurrect the demons that he remembers from his childhood. And Yahya Abdul-Mateen, the artist, turns out to be the baby who Helen Lyle steals at the end of the original
Candyman. Saves, yeah.
And well, it's Candyman steals the baby, takes it to the bonfire, which is also the way that the original short story mm-hmm. ends. And then Helen, you know, goes into the fire, dies, but dies saving the baby, who grows up to basically be this artist. So Coleman Domingo decides he's going to kidnap this guy and sacrifice him basically on the altar of Candyman so that the urban legend is resurrected. It's super convoluted. Like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And then, you know, all this stuff basically goes down. The cops come in. They kill him. You know, Yahya Abdul-Mateen's character dies, and then his girlfriend is arrested, and she's put in the back of the car. And now here's my thing. The ending doesn't make any sense, and it kind of sucks until the very last scene.
Yeah.
And the very last scene almost makes the entire movie worth it, because she resurrects Candyman while she's sitting in the back of this cop car being harassed by these white Cabrini Green Chicago police officers. She summons Candyman, and Candyman comes in and butchers these fucking cops, and it rules so hard. And then at the end, you know, she sees him in the alley swarmed with bees, and it becomes Tony Todd's face. And again, literalizes the whole central idea of like, the Candyman isn't just one guy. It's all of these different legends basically rolled up into one boogeyman. And he looks at her and he says, "Tell everyone." And the movie ends. And it's like, that's fucking awesome.
No, I agree. It got me this time. I was like, oh, that's a great fucking ending. But also watching it, I'm like, why wasn't that the whole movie?
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
I would have loved...
There's no setup for it.
There's no... Because you don't get to meet... I would have... Because even the fucking shitty-ass part three Candyman that has these cop characters...
Day of the Dead.
And you get a sense of comeuppance where there's a racist white cop who gets his and is blamed for the killings, which ends up allowing them to bury the Candyman legend and end it. They say, oh, it was all him. And it's like, that's a more interesting idea, because at least build that guy up over an hour and a half.
That's one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Oh, it's
sat
so bad.
Though.
It's so bad.
Like, Farewell to the Flesh isn't great, but A, it's directed by Bill Condon, who would go on to direct, you know, Dreamgirls and Chicago.
Well, and Gods and Monsters for
Gods
Barker,
and Monsters.
Who he produced.
Yeah. And like, incredible director, basically cuts his teeth making this very junky horror sequel, but it's also a reminder of a time when like junky horror sequels looked fucking awesome.
What's like City of Angels? Fucking Crow.
Yeah, The Crow.
Which isn't horror, but the same kind of idea.
But like, he sets it in New Orleans. He adds all of this backstory. It's lushly shot. Like, it has some really good mystery to it, to where you find out basically, like, the main character is essentially a descendant of Candyman, and it, like, has been covered up by, like, her racist dying mom?
Yes.
And, like, I was going to say
very
aunt
great,
at first.
Veronica Cartwright.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
she's really good in it. And there's, like, a real, almost, like... Again, Farewell to the Flesh isn't great, but it's almost like if you crossed Candyman with like a Tennessee Williams play.
Or Angel Heart.
Yeah, like it's super like high toned the entire time. Adds all the mythos to it to give it kind of like that Dream Warriors vibe. Like, just a reminder that like, sure, a fucking C-plus movie still went to theaters and looked like that.
Well, in the end set piece must have been half the budget. It's this, it's amazing. This whole thing where it's the slave quarters behind their old home where the mirror, Daniel's mirror is. And it's like in this big muddy wall where there's like fucking dead bodies, like these bones and shit.
It's
and then,
cool.
And then when he's kind of, they destroy the mirror, it all starts to be torn apart. There's this great shot of them. She saves all these kids or the kids come to help her. They're climbing this hill out and behind them, it's like a shot out of fucking Wizard of Oz. The house is like spinning in this whirlpool and being torn apart. It's like, good God, dude.
Yeah, it looks incredible.
It's fucking awesome.
But again, this is like, you know, a straight up programmer horror movie sequel that like came out in the mid 90s. But like at the time, this was a thing they tried to put in theaters and be like, hey, if we make 20 million off of this, that would be fucking great. Day of the Dead. Was that DTV?
Yeah,
I swear it was DTV.
It was 99.
Because it was Artisan back when they were putting stuff basically out for like blockbusters and shit. This movie looks like a fucking Skinamax movie.
Oh yeah.
It's terrible. Also, like,
and you have a playmate as the lead.
You're a playmate.
Talk about
as the
lead. Classy level down to this.
Yeah, you're practically waiting for Candyman to show up and be like, where are the white women at? Because and also she's supposed to be like his descendant.
No, it's the daughter of the girl from part two. It's
that's
the little
what I'm
girl.
Saying.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it continues that and becomes like half a rehash of Farewell to the Flesh. Because, like, and also, like, it's weird watching it because I watched these movies out of order. I watched the reboot, then I watched Farewell to the Flesh, then I watched Day of the Dead, then I watched the original. The worst possible order I could have watched these movies in. But, except for one thing, it made me realize that Day of the Dead kind of has the same plot as the reboot.
No, exactly.
Because it's all about an art dealer buying Daniel Robitaille's like original art, hanging it, and then that brings it back. They also do like a weird rehash of the Daniel Robitaille like legend, but it's shot for like $3 and a ham sandwich, it looks like. Fucking terrible movie. Also, like, the descendants of Candyman, like, I get it. He had sex with a white woman. They had a child together. But like, these women are so white that they're like the girl that you meet in a bar, and after like four drinks, she's like, you know, I'm 1/12 like Native American. And you're like, no, you're not. You're out of your fucking mind. Like, no way, man. Like, they could have done this a little better.
Well, because I mean, they get into the idea, and it's, I remember it's kind of a big thing in the amazing book by Walter Mosley in the movie Devil in the Blue Dress.
Yeah.
His idea of a woman passing, right? The idea of that they, if they're...
Or that movie that Rebecca Hall made, Passing.
Yeah, with her, you're fair-skinned enough, and it was... And that...
These girls are not fair-skinned.
That would have been a fascinating, like, fill-in movie, is to get to that era of that character. I'm like, oh, if you want to, like, get into, like, the mythos of Candyman, like, that's a fascinating story. But it's so... It doesn't work.
No, these girls are Gone Girl white.
Yeah.
Like, no fucking way, man. There's no, like, I don't believe you for one second.
But, you know.
Also, the Latino art dealer in this, worst character in a movie maybe ever. Worse than the white art dealer in the Candyman reboot, who's like, you know.
AJ Bowen.
Yeah, right. That's what I was going to say. I kept looking at him being like, that's not AJ Bowen. But like, does AJ Bowen have a cousin who's stupid? Like, was dropped on his head too many times when he was a child?
I mean, if I know that character is supposed to be unlikable, and I guess they pulled it off because I hate him so much.
There's a difference between unlikable and like just terribly written, though.
Yeah.
Like, he's so bad. He and the white art, all the white characters in the Candyman reboot, like, I get it. They're supposed to be the villains, but at least give them like some dialogue that doesn't make me want to kill myself.
Yeah, I mean, like, give me the Bradley Whitford stuff from, you know, from
Get Out. I voted for Obama twice,
you know. I'd vote for him a third time if I could. Well, and you know, it was interesting. So Bernard Rose, watching this thing, they had asked him to do the sequel after part one, so it was very successful.
But since they did all the reshoot, like, gore stuff, he basically said no.
Well, he said, I'll do, but I have an idea. And he wrote a screenplay, which I wish we could find. He adapted Midnight Meat Train.
Whoa.
And then said it was connected to Jack the Ripper. It's going to be in England. And then Candyman crosses over. It's about legends crossing over into other legends.
Oh.
I'm like, we got to find that fucking script.
Yeah, and that movie sounds fucking awesome.
And then, but Barker, I think he also shot it down. First of all, the studio is like, what the fuck is this? Where's Candyman? And Barker's also like, I kind of want to just someday do Midnight Meat Train. And I kind of like that one with Bradley Cooper.
I was going to ask you if you liked the Midnight Meat
Train. I like it.
I like it. I'm not a huge Kitamura fan in general.
Versus is so bad.
Yeah,
I really hate that movie.
Not a huge fan of his movies to begin with.
No One Lives is good, which I don't think
No
you've
One
seen.
Lives is pretty good.
Yeah.
What's the sniper one? Downrange.
Yes.
I like that one. That one's not bad, but like his early stuff, and I'm like, Midnight Meat Train, it shot really well. My big hang up with that film is just Vinnie Jones.
It's
like
weird casting.
He's kind of terrible. Yeah, it's weird. It's also during like the heyday of Vinnie Jones, like post, you know, Lockstock and Snatch and all the Guy Ritchie shit. And like, even wasn't he in the Mean Machine reboot too? The Longest Yard remake was Jason Statham, where Jason Statham's the goalie, I think, if I remember right.
Yep.
But like, that really is in the Vinnie Jones like revival. And it just doesn't. It doesn't feel right. Like, you want somebody more menacing and less cartoony as the main killer in that. But I will say, retaining the ending from the original story is pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, the whole, like, end of the line, like, the monsters living underneath the subterranean areas of London is just fucking... Or is it New York movie? It's London still, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I would have loved to have seen that. But it's also, like, you know... It is a series of films that, you know, I'm glad we got more, but it should have just ended with the first one. I mean, it's the definition of a closed...
Yeah,
you know,
closed circuit.
Well, closed circuit to the idea that Helen becomes, like, she's now going to be the new legend, right?
Somebody told me, and I can't remember, I might be telling stories out of class here, but somebody told me that in the original script for the Candyman reboot, one of the original ideas was Helen comes back.
Ooh.
And that's part of it.
Did you just continue that?
Yeah, of her luring. It was going to be like, and this is kind of why it was thrown out. It was like the appeal of the white woman luring one away, a black man away from his black girlfriend. And it was kind of like nixed to where it was like, I don't know, buddy.
Mm.
But like, she was... I don't know if they ever shot it, but it was definitely in early drafts to where she appeared in the Candyman reboot.
Interesting. Well, I also feel like some of the teeth kind of got taken out of this film by Velvet Buzzsaw beating it to, like, coming out. There was a lot of, like, similar... A lot of art stuff felt very, very similar to me.
Velvet Buzzsaw is its own thing, though, man. Like, that movie's operating on a wavelength that, hey, I'm not particularly fond of.
Yeah.
Except for all the Jake Gyllenhaal stuff. Like, he's fucking out of his mind. Could you imagine? And so we could do a thought experiment here. Could you imagine if we did the Candyman reboot as we know it, but you replaced the white characters in it with Jake Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo?
Oh, yeah.
From Velvet Buzzsaw. Like, just, you know what? Fuck Rene Russo. Just put Jake Gyllenhaal in the Candyman reboot as, like, the snooty white art critic. That movie is suddenly something else, man.
I just think your point, though, put it best of just, like, making the subtext text. And I struggled to be like, why do I hate this movie so much when it first came out? And beyond the fact that it was just like, it was just too convoluted. And again, the same thing that happened with the Hellraiser reboot is like, they tried to get too complicated with like the lament configuration. Like, oh, what if there's different shapes? Like, what are you doing?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, it's like, again, like Barker is so, it's the concept of, it's just Pandora's box. That's all it is. It's his version of Pandora's box. It ends there. Same thing. This guy is a legend. That's yeah. it. You don't need to get into the levels that we got to create him. We got to like find the new guy. It's like, or make a different movie. I mean, that's, it's just like, what are we doing here?
Well, and also, I mean, you can hear this in our original Hellraiser episode, but like the Hellraiser reboot committed the other sin of like now feeling weirdly dated, to where the Candyman reboot came at kind of the tail end, or maybe in the dead heat of social horror becoming a big thing, is that the Hellraiser one felt like it came at the tail end of what we now refer to, I guess, as trauma horror. Yeah,
absolutely.
Is that it's all like, you couldn't just have characters. They had to be working through some shit the whole time. And you're just like, again,
but also in a half-assed way.
Yeah. I'm not here for this, man. I'm here to watch the Cenobites fuck people up with chains. Like,
yep.
Like, just give me Pinhead and, you know, some aloof human characters who get sexually turned on by pain. You got yourself a Hellraiser movie. Instead, you're throwing too much Ari Aster in my Clive Barker.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, is I do think Barker is one of those creators who, the further he gets away from the property, the worse it is. You know, the further the property gets away from him. It's the same thing. It's like, I heard someone say about, it's a weird comparison, but the Rings of Power show. It's like, I don't want to see Tolkien worlds not written by Tolkien. Yeah. It's not just the elements. It's him as a storyteller. I don't want to see other people playing in there. It's bad.
Well, you know? And also, like, if you're going to do Tolkien, like, you should have a super fan like Peter Jackson.
Exactly.
Who gets what makes it work about it. Not a corporation like Amazon being yes. like, well, this is great IP that will lead to great content.
Yeah.
That rips the soul
yes.
out of Tolkien itself and Lord of the Rings. It's kind of what happens. Now, to be fair to Jordan Peele and Nia DaCosta, I feel like they're trying to retain a certain oh, yeah. soul to the Candyman reboot. It just doesn't quite work for me. But like the Hellraiser one is a better example that's closer to like the Lord of the Rings stuff, is that it's just like, they're like, well, you have this IP. I feel like a shithead saying this because I like Bruckner's movies for the most part, yep. but it's almost like we have this hot young director coming up. We can kind of make it about something, but like, this is what the kids want these days, you know?
Yep. And ugh.
No bueno. Want to get to questions?
Yes, sir.
Right. Questions about Candyman and the Clive Barker oeuvre in general. And that leads us to our first question. Can't really do rankings with the Candyman franchise because, A, there's only four of them.
And there's only one great one.
There's only one great one. And like, it would be kind of self-evident. It would just be Candyman, probably the Candyman reboot, Farewell to the Flesh, and we don't acknowledge Day of the yes. Dead in this household. So we decided to do more of a thought experiment here, and we're going to say, where does Candyman rank in the Clive Where does Candyman rank in the Clive Barker filmography?
I think it's my number one.
Yeah, me too.
With
Hellraiser being two.
Two for me is Lord of Illusions, which I love.
Shut your whore mouth.
I've told you this before, you get mad about it every time.
I like Lord of Illusions. I love it. Just come on, you're killing me
now. As a movie,
at least you didn't rank Nightbreed before them.
No. Come on. As a movie, I like Lord of Illusions. I just love Lord of Illusions so much. As a world, the world of Hellraiser is better, but I don't know. It's a toss up, and I would say Hellraiser 1 and 2 are kind of can be interchangeable. You know, they kind of go together. Is one piece, sure. I think. And then you get into some... Then Nightbreed. Then Rawhead Rex. Actually, Nightbreed, and then, like, if we're counting other people's films, obviously, so that you do, like, Midnight Meat Train. And then... Probably Rawhead Rex, and then I think Underworld's probably the worst thing to be made.
I might like Underworld more than Rawhead Rex, but mine isn't too far off. Neither one of them.
Actually, I think
good.
I do like it better than Rawhead Rex. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I like some of it. The music's cool. It has that cool 80s vibe.
Yeah.
But like besides that.
It's not great, yeah. But it's like, it's interesting at the very least. But yeah, mine would probably go Candyman, Hellraiser, Lord of Illusions, Nightbreed. Yeah. Underworld and Rawhead Rex.
Yeah.
Rawhead Rex sucks.
You know, when I first saw it as a kid, I tracked it down for so long. I was like, because
hard to see for the longest time.
Yeah, there was like, it was on VHS, but I was just like, I gotta see it. And I remember because the cover, he looked cool looking when you first see the image of like him on, not the full on face shot, which looks like a fucking cartoon, but like him on the profile with like the lightning behind him is badass.
Yeah.
And then you watch it, you're like, and it was the same director who did that in Underworld.
I know.
And I know Barker was unhappy with both of them.
Sir, I don't like you.
Well, that's what kind of was the impetus for Hellraiser, right? Is like, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah. If anybody's going to adapt my work and fuck it up, it's going to be me.
Yeah.
So, double feature.
I thought a lot about this today, and the original Ju-on from Japan, also very urban, has mm-hmm. the sense of like curse leading to curse leading mm-hmm. to curse.
Sure.
Or Exuma from Korea, which is also a cool like mystery thing about the history of a space and the history of like a place and a curse that's there that you think is one thing, but it's another, and it's all. I think it goes together very well, the idea of a legend as well and how a legend can grow.
I would just go with urban legend and Candyman.
Yeah.
And just literalize it.
Yeah.
And like have a lot of fun with urban legend. I don't know. I haven't seen it in so long. That would be another reason why I would want to do it is just to revisit it. Because like I remember seeing it in theaters when I was, I don't know, like 13 or 14 or mm-hmm. whatever it was. Watched it on DVD and... like a few times, and then I got the Blu-ray. I don't know if I ever watched the Blu-ray though. So, but you know,
watched it last year.
Yeah, except for Jared Leto.
What's you got? Jared Leto, Alicia Witt. No, sorry, not Alicia Witt. The other actress. And then Michael, what's his name from Supernatural? Joshua Jackson.
Tony Todd.
No, he's in Final Destination. It's Robert Englund.
Tony Todd is the professor. No, he's the janitor. No, he's the lunch guy.
He's not
at the college. Are you sure?
I'm 100%, yeah. Get Robert Englund as the...
It would be hilarious if Tony Todd was the lunch like lady at the college. And they're just in line. He's like, be my victim. They're like, okay, Earl, just give me some more mac and cheese.
I want some more green corn, please. Well... What I've always liked this movie, obviously, for the simple fact is I love campus slashers, and that's why I watch it a lot. I watched a couple of months ago, and it's that neo slasher era, you know. But it looks great. I think they shot it
post screen.
They shot it in Canada, I think, at a college in Canada. But it has an
old... God, you said that with such disdain for Canada, like, Canada of all fucking places.
What a bunch of assholes! And it's Jamie Blanks who did
like that in South Africa. I thought Jamie Blanks did Final Cut.
No, he did this one.
Did he do the first one?
He might have done Final Cut as well, but he definitely did the first one.
Okay,
yeah. Final Cut's rough.
Yeah.
Not my favorite.
No. Since we already have a reboot,
mm-hmm.
we're going to take our usual question of remake, reboot in a different direction and say, what Clive Barker story would you like to see adapted that you've never seen adapted?
Well, my number one's probably pretty easy that you already know about. It's Cold Heart Canyon. It would be a book.
Oh, yeah. That was going to be my pick, too.
But if not, that would, I think, would do better as an HBO miniseries. It's a pretty sprawling. Too big. The book is, it's Stephen King. It's one of Barker's, like, Stephen King-like books. He's, like, 800-page, really involved, lots of characters, lots of time periods. But for those who haven't read it, it's a really cool setup of there's this action star. He's basically Tom Cruise, and he's kind of at the end of his hot boy days, and he's starting to wane. He believes if he gets the right kind of plastic surgery, this high-end plastic surgery to make him young again, he'll be back on top. And it's like a chemical skin peel kind of thing they do for him, and it goes wrong.
Yeah.
And so he's bandaged up, and they are like, well, he can't be in public. We need to like let him heal and say he's gone. And so his handlers find this old movie palace mansion in the hills of like Laurel Canyon type of area that was basically was kind of owned by a Norma Desmond type Theda Bara silent movie actress who was known for very hedonistic parties, who might have also been involved in some supernatural stuff. So this guy basically moves in, he's trying to heal, and it awakens this kind of this old evil in the house. But the coolest part is the reason it's there is she was obsessed with her home country of Romania, and they brought over these this mosaic from this old abbey that is like the history of this, called like the Wild Hunt or something. They put it on the wall there, which is probably what's brought the evil of this other kind of hellraisery world of this hunt that comes through into our world. And it just goes absolutely fucking crazy. And if not that, I would do Pig Blood Blues from Books of Blood. I think it's the first volume, which takes place at a boy's juvenile center for criminals. And there's a young kid, and he starts to realize something is wrong with his kids, and they're worshiping. There's like a pigsty that's run by the people there outside of their kind of prison area, where there's a giant sow they kind of worship as this goddess, and they're feeding these kids to it. And it's just this badass, only Barker could think of a story like that. I think it'd be a really great, like 90 minute, like period piece, 80s reformatory school with British kids. Or you could do it in America. I think it'd work here too. You know, some kind of like work camp for kids.
I always love that story too. And I always imagine someone like from the French New Extreme doing it.
100%.
Like Alexander Aja.
Yes.
Or,
yeah. Adding some more beats to it.
Doing it and really leaning into how gnarly it gets at certain points. Like, great, great pick.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with kind of in the same vein as what you talked about with Cold Heart Canyon. I always wanted to see, well, I guess you can't really call it a trilogy because the third book was never released and probably will never be released, you know, since Clive Barker's health keeps getting worse and worse. Yeah. And we might not want it to after, you know, that last Hellraiser book that he released, The Crimson Gospels, which I enjoyed quite a bit.
Scarlet Gospels. Yeah.
Or Scarlet Gospels, I'm sorry. I enjoyed it quite a bit, but it's also clear that he did not write it.
No way. Absolutely not.
And I would want to do the trilogy of the art, the Book of the Art,
yeah,
with Great and Secret Show and Everville,
yeah,
which I love both of those books. And then there's apparently supposed to be a third book, but I guess I don't even know how to describe the main story of this because it's almost about like two beings who transcend mortality. They're looking for essentially the key to like life itself, and they become superhumans. And this is what we were talking about, like Barker's kind of forays into straight fantasy. Like,
yeah,
this borders on it quite a bit because it really goes into the fantastical stuff. Like, cause there's like the Book of Quiddity that they're attempting to harness to where like human beings are only allowed to like enter because it essentially unlocks your dreams, and you're only allowed to enter like the Sea of Dreams like three times. Man, I want to say
so long since I read the
throughout
first one, yeah.
like the course of your life, and it allows you to basically see like what your future is and everything, and like it's just a great sprawling, weird work of imagination, and Everville just really builds on the world and kind of takes it in another direction. And you always kind of claim that the third book was going to be the one that, you know, explains like the origins of Quidditch, and because it also has like, because Harry D'Amore mm-hmm. from Lord of Illusion shows up in Everville, and like he also shows up in Scarlet Gospels and yeah. stuff. He clearly was like one of Barker's favorite creations.
He's kind of his only like returning hero.
Yeah.
You see other villains, but few heroes.
That noirish private
yeah,
exactly, eye.
Yeah. Which I would have loved to just see in a complete collection of like Jim Butcher style, The Adventures of Harry D'Amore.
Oh, those would be a lot of fun. Yeah. Do you bring Scott Bakula back or do you have somebody else play
He's
him?
Great. I love him in that role.
He's really, really good. Yeah. I always imagined D'Amore in my head more of like Mickey Rourke from Angel Heart.
Oh, yeah. I think there's no way there's not a mental.
A connection right yeah. there. But no, that would be my pick. Great and Secret Show in Everville, and like make that into like an HBO series or Netflix series or stuff, because they're like Cold Heart Canyon, far too sprawling and full of ideas to just contain to one film.
And that's just the thing about Barker too, is like King, a lot of the stuff that's adapted really well for him has been short story.
Yeah.
I mean, also Lord of Illusions was a novella from Cabal. You know, also Cabal.
Nightbreed
was from Cabal. And he's such an idea guy. And like,
I mean, King, Hellbound Heart Hellraiser is a novella.
Super short, but because he's such an idea guy that he never has trouble. He jumps into like these really epic things really quickly. I mean, even again, like Thief of Always, just like.
There was supposed to be an animated.
It went through like four producers, man. Like, and it was like 20 years ago they were talking about it.
I feel like somebody huge worked on it mm-hmm. too, like a Brad Bird or something like that, to where it was going to be.
There was concept art done. Like, it was. And it's like an amazing. We actually did a play of it at my school. So, seventh grade, we adapted it.
Who played the house?
My friend Nathan, but I was the kid. I got to play the lead. Yeah. So there's a video somewhere, but I'd already read it. I was already a big Barker fan, and it was seventh grade, and they announced this, and I was like, what are the odds? You know, and my teacher was a big
fan.
What
a weird elementary school you went to.
Middle school.
Oh, middle school? Doesn't matter. It's still weird.
Yeah, but we did a whole very long play. And yeah, the house was my buddy like up
on. Was it directed by the kid from Rushmore?
We had a helicopter come in.
Yeah.
But that was just a random thing. I was like, wait, we're doing Clive Barker. And I've been obsessed with him since like fourth grade, I think, is when I got into him. And I think I read Thief of Always probably.
This explains why you're such a fucking pervert.
I mean, yeah. But, well, I remember like.
Clive Barker's like, hey.
Well, once like when I met him, he's like, you're tall, you know? But like.
I'll suck your dick.
That book, Shadows of Eden. On him, I used to read
Shadows of Eden.
Oh, I know, dude. That was the weirdest thing when you meet your hero and he just ogles you. You're like, hey, nice to meet you. I've loved you since I was a kid. Oh, really? You're like, yep.
I don't know if I could fit all of you into my mouth.
I'm gonna leave now, Mr. Barker, but it's been a pleasure.
Who's your lady boyfriend? So, is Candyman a face melter? Yay or nay?
Nay.
Are we sure? It might be.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it is. I guess I'm thinking like.
You're so easily swayed.
Yeah.
Now that you bring it up.
Well, I mean.
I do like French fries.
But it's such of a piece. It's like one. It's one of those movies that you kind of washes over you. So in that sense, it's just like you plug into the movie and kind of let it take you. So I think for a first time viewer, I can imagine like you were saying, like first time you saw it. I remember when I first saw it, scared the shit out of me. I can imagine
and
someone
it still
today,
scares me. It's still That's scary. The only reason I really consider it a face melter is that because few movies, you know, however, what, 32 years on or whatever from like when they were first released. And, you know, we'll just say like 25 years from when I first saw it, like, still have the ability to scare me.
Yep. Yeah. So let's call it a face melter.
Sure.
A provisional face melter.
Welcome to the club, Mr. Robot's Eye. Here's your participation trophy.
You get to hang out with Luke Devereaux from Hard Target.
Yeah. Because your mama took one.
my mama took one.
Well, Martin, this has been great.
Yes.
You know, we didn't really veer into any real absurdist territory this time, nor did I get to call you an incel.
Just did.
Oh, shit. Nor did I get to chastise you for making us sit through Paper House at the Exhumed Films 24-hour movie marathon. And I thought I would, because that does tie back to Bernard Rose, but you somehow dodged a bullet on that sub-Neil Jordan piece of shit that you bailed on
I'm just that good.
Holding my dick. But are we doing Ozploitation next, or are you going to need more time?
I can do it.
You sure?
Yes.
I don't want to promise the people things that we can't do. But if we don't, we're not, you know what? We're not going to tell you what we're going to do next time. Martin might still be in love.
I will be.
He'll be on dates, going through the tunnel of love on a romantic boat ride.
Thank you, Jacob. Thank you.
Feeding each other candy corn.
He only brings it up because I have a big bag of candy corn here that he made fun of me for eating.
Fuck candy corn, dude. I'm sorry, Val, if you're listening to this. Your presence seemed nice, but candy corn is, you know, an unholy act against all that is good in the world.
I think it's delicious.
Yeah, well, you can go fuck yourself, and then you guys can tune in next time to see how much of this candy corn I stuff into Martin's ass on Secret Handshake.
Bye. Thank you.